You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, March 19th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, with his piece from the New Democracy Journal, Mike Konzel on the voluntarism fantasy. I don't know why I had trouble saying that. I think it was the sound of all of these libertarians' heads exploding. Also on the program today, industrial civilization headed for collapse? Maybe, says a NASA study. Also on the program today, the NSA, remember how they said that they weren't, remember their idea of bulk and the idea of capturing phone calls? Turns out the NSA has a program which records all the phone calls of an unnamed country, perhaps more, stores them, and then goes back to check them out. Meanwhile, it's got the office in stitches this morning. Two new Republican, I guess they are RNC ads, targeted to millennials. A couple of things we've learned. The millennials, they never, ever look you in the eye.
I'm wondering why you're looking at me when you're saying that point.
Because
Sam,
I'm not a millennial.
It doesn't seem that
sincere. I don't know why you're looking back at me. That's what the real question is.
But I'm not taking this seriously. Right now, you can tell me
Michael's
I'm way off to the left.
Just off of the yes.
Yeah. Because I'm really serious about this segment and how important it is to me.
I think folks get the idea that we can't wait to talk about this stuff. But first, we should also say today is the 11-year anniversary of the illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq. I believe this is when Shock and Awe was launched. And good time to look back on all the D-bags who not only got it wrong, but really tisked the liberals or just rational people who are saying, why are we doing this? Maybe I'll read from Matt Miller at that time, just because he's running for election in California. And maybe one person could be held slightly, just marginally accountable. But before we get there, folks, it seems that Ken Langone has apologized. He is the billionaire founder or co-founder of Home Depot. And as you know, the other day, he said, and I quote, "I hope it's not working," referring to the populist pushback on wealth inequality in this country. Because if you go back to 1933 with different words, this is what Hitler was saying in Germany. You don't survive as a society if you encourage and thrive on envy or jealousy. Yes, very, very different words, I think, is what Hitler was using. Words that actually didn't have anything to do with what Ken Langone's talking about. But he did apologize. He released a statement yesterday. Quote, "My remarks were intended to discourage pitting one group against another group in society." if my choice of words was inappropriate, and they may well have been. So he's saying they weren't necessarily inappropriate, but if they were, and he adds, and there's a slight chance they may have been, though I'm not going to concede that I was wrong, I extend my profound apologies to anyone and everyone who I may have offended. In other words, I'm not conceding that what I said was wrong. We still very well may be in 1933 Nazi Germany here. But there's a slight chance I'm wrong about that. But either way, if some of you just couldn't handle it, well, then I feel bad for you. So Ken Langone showing that not only is he a moron, but he's still very much an a-hole. And I am waiting for the Republicans to dissociate himself from him and, frankly, Governor Cuomo of this state, who is also a receives a part of Ken Langone's largesse. Be that as it may, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Mike Konzel. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Mike Konzel. He's got a piece in the New Democracy Journal. We'll put a link to it at majority.fm. It's entitled The Voluntarism Fantasy. Welcome to the program, Mike.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
I love this piece because I have literally had this argument with maybe not hundreds, but certainly tens of libertarians who have called into the show. And I'm saying well into the tens, the double digits, close to triple digits maybe, about this concept of it's a dual concept. One is that there was a time where we didn't need this government interference. And the other part of that argument is that we don't need it again in terms of taking care of people. And you have a great piece. And let me just start with it. Conservatives tell themselves a story, a fairy tale, really. What is that fairy tale, Mike?
So as you described, it's a story about the idea that before the New Deal, and particularly in the 19th century, before the progressive era, you know, we took care of poverty through civil society, through, you know, communities coming together, through people looking out for each other, often in voluntary societies. And we were able to combat poverty, we were able to combat poverty in old age, we were able to combat health insurance and unemployment and the other things that are the kind of big risks we have in our society. And second is that the New Deal and the Great Society are kind of, you know, they're the kind of anomalies in that if we got rid of them, we could return to that society where small communities and local communities could take care of one another again. And so it means that we could, you know, And crucially, what it means is if we do things like cut spending, if we cut food stamps, we cut Social Security, it may be painful for a very short period, but essentially we together would come together in kind of voluntary groups and take care of each other. And I think that's really problematic.
Yeah. Well, let's start with, by the end, I want to get into, you know, sort of what is the foundation of why they tell themselves this fantasy. But before we get there, let's look at this empirically. Was this the case? I mean, was the 1890s and the early, I guess, 20th century just a period of when people would charity would make up for this? And you know, there was no poor people really, unless they just wanted to be poor, I guess.
Exactly. So it's interesting. There's a lot of reasons why a lot of people tend to emphasize the idea that there was no state or there was no public or there was no government in the 19th century. Because one is, I think a lot of people really want to emphasize that the New Deal was a big break. So they really want to down, especially like liberals want to do that. And a lot of libertarians want to kind of have this golden compass that they can return to at any point in time. But that has just never been the case. The state has always played a role between poorhouses, between essentially local requirements that churches take care of people who are homeless or otherwise in deep poverty, to, you know, like the government's role in dealing with floods and other kinds of insurance policies, you know, the government's role in expanding the West and building out this public infrastructure, government's role in businesses and corporate licenses and bankruptcy codes that allow businesses to have a kind of risk insurance and social insurance as well. You know, the government is just a really deep roots. And when you go after the Civil War, it's even deeper because you have Civil War pensions that were kind of a precursor to Social Security. And so you have a really deep government. So the idea that there was ever this kind of laissez-faire system is totally a lie, and it's wrong in just a historical manner. We walk through the history of that. What was true is that there was a laissez-faire in the sense that the courts would always strike down worker protections and strike down unions and strike down minimum wage and hour laws, and that was consistent until the New Deal. So, but there was always the role of the state in structuring markets and structuring the way we deal with social insurance. The thing is, those systems tend to be very pro-corporate, and they also, with things like poorhouses, tended to be very demeaning, very difficult for people who were experiencing poverty, especially in old age.
All right, so let's talk about a little bit of that of the social insurance system that existed, you know, prior to the Great Depression and the New Deal. I mean, let's talk about this idea of things like business risk management and let's start with that. I mean, what does that mean, and how did it play a role back in the late 1800s, early 1900s that libertarians in particular seemed to pine for?
Right. Well, I mean, if you look at things like a corporate charter, which is, you know, a very much a government construction. I mean, it was created at the state level and expanded out. Out of the Northeast. And it allows things for, like, if you're a shareholder of a company and the company goes bankrupt, you don't get thrown in debtor's prison, right? You know, you're not on the hook for those losses in the way that people were back in the day or back in, you know, earlier than the 19th century, which meant that in practice you could suddenly get a lot of capital raised to build businesses that could stretch across the country. I mean, you could invest in things like railroads or shipping companies or things that are going to be much larger than a local business. So, you know, the actual scale and crucially the industrialization of the United States went in tandem with ways that the government created legal structures to help, you know, share risks among businesses. Now, it was only a matter of time before that same kind of logic would be extended to workers around the New Deal and to everyone with the Great Society.
But I see, I think that point, you know, I want to really hammer this point, because that is a form. I mean, things like bankruptcy, things like liability kept at arm's length is a form of insurance that then is leveraged by people in the same way that I can take risks maybe with, you know, in my life, because I know that Social Security is there, and at the very least, I won't be destitute on the street. But this is a social insurance for businesses.
Absolutely. Like most forms of insurance, it limits the worst case scenario, right? So if you are trying to save money during your life, but you can't do it, or you make a bad investment, you know, Social Security makes sure you have a basic minimum in old age. Same thing with shareholders, that even if, you know, you invest in a company and it goes terribly wrong, you're not going to, your losses are limited. You will only lose what you invested. You're not on the hook for this extra stuff. That's very difficult for you to manage. So, you know, if you invested in, you know, pets.com, that maybe have been a terrible decision, but you're not going to owe bondholders all this money. But if you invested in, I don't know, General Electric, it may have been a very good deal. So, you know, the government's always been, had a very crucial role in building out our country. And that's, you know, not to be, you know, the whole you didn't build that thing, you know, is relevant here. I mean, you know, there's always been a partnership. And the industrialization, the real economic might of the way the country was built up during the 19th century, was always joined at the hip with the state.
All right. So let's talk about, you know, more sort of, I guess, obvious social insurance systems that took place, you know, or existed during that era. You mentioned that churches were actually, you know, sort of, I guess, forced in some way or coerced by the state to provide some relief for people.
Right, right. So, so when you talk, it's interesting because some people have accused me of attacking a straw man in this piece, but I don't think I have, because
no.
If you talk to enough people, and if you particularly talk to enough libertarians, this is always animating their discussions. The idea that, you know, we have this voluntary system that worked so well, and it was only in the government's coercion is like really ruined things, or, you know, made things much worse. What I wanted to point out, first of all, is that the old system that existed was really spotty, and it was nowhere near up to the needs of an industrializing society. I mean, when you had things where people were really dependent on the business cycle, when people were really dependent on employers who did not have deep relationships with them. If you had, you know, the kind of modern society of, you know, industrialization and worker capitalism, you know, suddenly it's really hard to, you know, have money saved up for old age. It's really, you know, people's bodies were being destroyed all the time through industrialization. So disability was a really big concern. You know, and if you're not able to work, or if you're disabled, or if you're older, then you're suddenly in a lot of trouble. And so, when you actually look at these old societies, really what the big benefit they provided was funeral benefits, because people were really worried about suddenly dying and leaving their family with a really big financial burden to be buried and have a proper funeral. But when you actually look at the old age pensions of the time that were privately given, the equivalent of the 401k of their day, like the 401k of our days, like it was not sufficient to meet the needs of people in old age. So you had other state facilities like poorhouses, which were deeply humiliating for the people in them. And there's no even presumption of dignity in old age for people who had to live in these places that were designed to be punitive, to keep people out of them. And so, like, the old system was really brutal, and the system that arose, and crucially, then the Great Depression just basically bulldozed it. And we can talk a little bit about that. But, you know, by the time when the Great Depression forced a lot of people into need, all those systems collapsed, which led to the New Deal that we had and we still have today for now.
Yeah, all right. So that's the point, is that there was in existence sort of like very spotty, state mandated, literally state governments in some instances, or state government established, and some federal government programs after the, I guess, the Civil War, we saw some of those programs. And then as much suffering was still going on at that point, and sort of just, I guess, there was just not the political ability to address that suffering. I mean, you know, back on the Bowery in the early 1900s, you had something like 20,000 to 30,000 people literally living on the street of the Bowery at that time. And then essentially we have the Great Depression, and it functions like a tsunami. It just it washes away these structures, and talk about why they specifically couldn't deal with it. I mean, the notion that charity would then, or what we perceive as charity, or charitable outlets would then rise to the occasion is exactly the opposite of what happens.
Yeah, there's a great book called Making a New Deal, which really walks through this. And you have, especially during the 1920s, you have a lot of immigrant communities, especially in the big cities, that have built up these private charitable organizations. And you're talking about things like private banks, you know, private lending facilities, private insurance, essentially forms of wage insurance. So if you were unemployed for a week or two, you know, you'd get a little bit of money and then you'd kind of pay it back later. The Great Depression did a couple things very quickly. One is that it just increased the demand for wage support, or for, you know, everyone was in a lot of trouble, and it was the equivalent of people needing unemployment insurance or food stamps. And so, you know, there was a huge demand for it. And exactly at the same time, this is the second punch, that people were tightening their spending, right? You know, we see this in our recession as well. If people were afraid to donate, afraid to put money out there because they themselves are worried about their standing. So, you know, there's a huge demand, and then the supply also contracts on the charities. And the third, and the third really big part is that the normal way, especially when you have a new wage earning force, that people deal with uncertainty is just, you know, putting more hours on the workforce. But you couldn't do that when unemployment was 10, 15, 20, 25% as it was during the Great Depression. So, it was designed, the system was very fragile. It did not have the deep penetration it needed to really stabilize spending or really stabilize the welfare of the country. And secondarily, it did not have the deep pockets necessary to survive through this kind of things. So you saw these things collapse one after the other. And workers at that time saw this and said, you know what, we are, you know, we're proud people. We don't want to, you know, we actually are, you know, there's a lot of reasons for this, but they suddenly turned to the idea that, you know, the state can actually do this well, and it can do this in a way that's not totalitarian, it's not going to be intrusive, it's not going to be bad for people. It's just that we're going to have an insurance system that's run through the federal government that will take care of things like unemployment, disability, and old age. And, you know, ideally at the time they should have taken care of healthcare as well, but they did not. And that system has worked, and it's worked incredibly well. And I walk through how it's worked really well in the Great Recession, because that's, we've also seen a decline in charitable giving during the Great Recession the last 5 years, in a way where, you know, food stamps and unemployment insurance went out immediately and helped save the economy.
Yeah. Now those in particular are called automatic stabilizers. Just you know, talk about just tell us what that means and how they function and how they ebb and flow based upon just basically need, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So a nice thing. So you know, when the housing bubble collapsed, a lot of people got very nervous and stopped spending so much. Corporations stopped investing. And then we saw the Great Recession really died. And the Federal Reserve was put in check on what it could do to try to boost the economy, especially in the short term. And so what you saw was that there was a big fall in spending. However, because people became unemployed, because people became poor, the government automatically kicked out money to increase spending. So you saw food stamps go up. It's been a big controversial debate. You saw unemployment insurance go out as people lost their jobs. They got their income stabilized through unemployment insurance. You know, people pay into these things through their taxes, through, you know, indirectly through state taxes. The crucial thing, one of the nice things about automatic stabilizers, they automatically go up when, I mean, this is the automatic part, when demand is weak, when people are suffering, and then they automatically come back down as the economy recovers. In fact, we're already starting to see food stamps and unemployment insurance go down independent of the cuts that are brutal and unnecessary. The logical endpoint of that is very useful, right? Because that it kicks in demand, it kicks in people, allowing people to spend to boost the economy exactly at the times that we need it.
And just so that people conceptually, you know, understand this, it's not that the amounts go up; it is that the number of people who are eligible increases, not because of any change in eligibility, but simply because people essentially fall into the realm of eligibility.
Yeah, and it's crucial. And the thing is, to just say one more time clearer, Amayan, It goes up when the economy is starting to weaken, and it goes up automatically when the economy is starting to weaken. Charitable giving, what we saw in the Great Recession, has actually declined as the economy was going into collapse. And it declined even as a percentage of the economy. And when people went out and asked people, because there's a whole industry that watches charitable giving in the country, it was simply because people were fearful about their budget. They were worried about money in their pocket. So they gave less. And that's exactly when you don't need that to happen. So there's a lot, you know, I walk through kind of a theory of why charitable giving is a bad substitute for a proper social insurance state. And there's issues about, you know, the penetration of it and how broad the coverage is. But it's also this issue of when things get bad, the government can step up in a way no other entity can. You know, if we were reliant, you know, automatic stabilizers went up about 2%, 3% of GDP at the beginning of the Great Recession, which is equivalent to all charitable giving in the country. And crucially, all charitable giving goes, a lot of it goes to Harvard, a lot of it goes to your favorite opera hall to get, you know, your favorite rich person's name on it. Only a little bit of it actually goes to income security, as we understand.
That's what, so, I mean, you break down three different type of voluntary failures. One is that philanthropic insufficiency. I guess this is, based on a study that Lester Solomon did. One is the insufficiency, which you've covered. And then the particularism is this notion of, when people are giving charity, in some respects, there's the big money goes to, you know, building a wing at Lincoln Center or, a new laboratory at Harvard. It doesn't necessarily address what the problems are.
Yeah, I mean, there's a big thing about how I think one of the largest charitable donations is just given to Harvard, which if you actually look at its bank account, it's like a hedge fund with the university attached to it.
Uh-huh.
And it has a huge money. And then, I mean, it's exactly what you would not donate to try to make sure people were able to keep a roof over their head or had food on their plates. And so, yeah, if we want a welfare state to ensure dignity for people who are in poverty, for people who are in old age and can't work, you know, the private charities is designed not to do those kinds of things. It's designed to allow people with the money to kind of pick and choose what they want to support. And they're going to pick and choose a lot of things that kind of, you know, build up cultural capital among other elites, or that they particularly want to stigmatize other kinds of populations, which is exactly what we don't want to be doing.
All right. So let's broaden this out a little bit, because, you know, I think anybody who thinks that you're arguing or creating a straw man has not been paying attention, I think, to at least a large sector, it seems to me, of what is animating younger people in the Republican Party, and then B, the sort of the underpinnings of things that like Paul Ryan go out and talk about. This is at least what I use this term loosely, the intellectual underpinnings of what they're arguing. But, I mean, why? I mean, it seems fairly easy to go back and look at the sort of the empirical reality about this. Why do you think this story is told? I mean, because on one level, the argument you're making is that, A, is twofold. One is that we never lived at a time where there was no state intervention in social insurance, very broadly speaking, and two, that when it was minimal, it was not up to the task. And why we have today what we have today, it seems to me like that argument is made less based on sort of like, or I should say, the counter argument is made less based upon data and more on wishful thinking to justify essentially a worldview that libertarians have.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at it, I see three broad trends. One is that people on the right want lower taxes on the rich and less money going through the government, full stop. So when you actually look at how the government spends its money, it spends a lot of it on health care and old age pensions through Social Security and income support for poor people. And, you know, if you need to cut money, that's where you're going to cut it, and especially if you want to, conversely, lower taxes. The second is I think a lot of people on the right, in different versions of the statement, have a real allergy to the public and to democracy and to the idea that we're in this together, and we're going to ensure a baseline of support for people when they're vulnerable. They would prefer to see things go through private hands, things to go through markets or for-profit institutions. I mean, the classic one is private accounts for Social Security. You know, George W. Bush would have actually ran a much larger deficit in Social Security, you know, for all the deficit hawk allergy stuff about Social Security. You know, they would have blown a huge hole solely for the purpose of running it through Wall Street and solely through the purposes of putting all that risk on each individual, because I think that very ideological vision of how risk emboldens people or enlivens people or, you know, makes them, you know, existentially at risk or something, where, you know, I think security is much more important for liberals and for regular people when they're actually asked about these things. And then, you know, the third is I think there's a kind of nostalgic and romanticism to a lot of conservative thought. I mean, I think, you know, Corey Robin wrote a book called Reactionary Mind that's really good on this. For all the talk about, like, you know, sober, bougie kind of, you know, button down conservatives, there's a real kind of reactionary nostalgia for a, you know, old times when men were men and things were better, that animates a lot of this. And that can kind of drive this kind of 19th century conquerors, you know, frontiersman society that doesn't exist anymore.
Well, I mean, I want to also touch on, you quoted President Truman in a, I guess it was a 1946 radio address, in his definition of charity, because I think, you know, at the end of the day, I think this is where the perspectives on what the function of society is supposed to be about, you know, because I don't think that, I mean, the arguments that voluntarism is a more efficient way of providing for the poor or for society's needs, you know, those who have not, those who need it the most, it just seems to be founded upon nothing. Like you say, it's a fantasy. I think at the end of the day, it is just a way of justification of it really isn't our responsibility. So what happens, happens. And Truman had a different definition of charity that was more encompassing, I think, than the one that we hear, I think, in general used today, but certainly on the right. Just touch briefly on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Another thing, and, you know, this thing's obviously a critique of the right, but it's also a nudge to liberals as well, for a couple reasons. And two big ones is, one is that, you know, there's often a tension being seen between civil society and our private lives and our community and then the state, which is this kind of bureaucracy in a tall building far away, when it's, you know, you can actually, it's very clear, and it was very clear at the time of the Great Depression, is that they're intertwined and that they can bolster each other. So, you know, when you're looking at the Great Depression, you have a lot of charitable organizations, a lot of civic community groups, churches, who are saying, we can't provide, we don't have the resources or the infrastructure to actually deal with the mass economic insecurity that comes with an industrial and now post-industrial society. We can't provide everyone an old age pension. That's the proper role of the state. We can do much more targeted and much more useful things about, you know, say drug addiction or say counseling, or, you know, we are much more nimble creatures where these huge burdens, these huge kind of almost atlas-like structures of having to hold up the real, you know, hold up people against economic risk is the proper role of the state. And by allowing the state to do these things, it's, we can treat each other much more as equals and actually target problems as a community and as civil society that's much easier. And the second thing is, I think liberals, and we're going to make some tough choices in the next decade about whether or not we need to lean more privately or publicly on things. I mean, the retirement crisis and Social Security is the most obvious place on this. And I think there's always been, especially in the last couple of decades, and you see in things like Bowling Alone, and, you know, liberals tend to really romanticize some of this stuff, and they seem to be much more uncomfortable with the public than where they need to be right now. And we need to really get liberals to reexamine this and really refound themselves in the idea that by doing stuff like increasing Social Security, we're not robbing civil society. We're actually allowing it to be much more richer and more complete by you know, completing this project.
Well, what do you make of that argument that, you know, if we didn't have taxes, then there'd be a lot more money for charity?
you know, there'd be some, but the charity would go in a lot of, it wouldn't do the things we want social insurance to do. So, I mean, you know, you'd see a lot more, you know, people would bid up the name on that goes on the fancy opera in New York or whatnot, or bid up the names that go on the dorms at Harvard. You know, there would be some, but it, and then the other thing is that it would be spotty. It'd be bad coverage. It would be, you know, in certain areas and not in other areas. It hit certain people and not other people. And the big thing is it wouldn't be consistent. It would kind of come and go with the whims of people who have the money to donate. And that's not what we need social insurance to do. We need that. That is the opposite of economic security, which in turn leads to an economic really kind of freedom.
Well, Mike, I love the piece, The Voluntarism Fantasy. It is at the New Democracy Journal. We got a link to it at majority.fm. Really appreciate your taking the time to come and talk to us about it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will we got to get to these ads.
First thing, we got to go to the ads first.
Oh,
thing.
Definitely.
Look at the IM.
The
I say.
New, what is that? It's Just Democracy?
Yeah, it's not New Democracy.
Oh, I'm sorry. Democracy Journal. Yes. His new Democracy Journal piece. It's a new piece in Democracy Journal.
Indeed.
I misspoke.
Yeah.
I'm sorry about that.
No big deal. I just want to make sure you got it.
All right. In the funner half, we will get into the millennial ads that the Republicans have put out, which are pretty hilarious. Also, it turns out that Chick-fil-A regrets that they ever weighed in, despite the fact that are they still not doing like Chick-fil-A days where people go in and bring their guns into Chick-fil-A's or whatever it is that they do to eat their chicken? And we have more data on retirement, the disaster that is the 401k. And are you laughing because that's the fun part of the show?
There's the Cedar fun half.
There we go.
I like it.
And the hilarious story of Paul Ryan, whose grandparents came over from Ireland because of the potato famine, and the hilarious things the British had to say at the time about whether or not they would release the stores of food, the massive amounts of grain and food they had stored, to those Irish people. Just go, you're going to double over laughing when you hear what they had to say back in the day.
Because of course the famine was a distribution problem, as always.
No, it wasn't. You're stepping on that joke, buddy. That's not really a joke. And then, also, this is a laugh riot. Is industrial civilization headed for a collapse? As this NASA study.
So from fun to wonky to terrifying. Half.
Right.
Okay.
It's going to be like a roller coaster.
I would recommend people get on YouTube if you're not watching on YouTube, because the first bit that we're going to do in the fun part of the fun half, which is these amazing RNC ads, may involve a little bit of there's a visual aspect to these ads.
Really? You mean these video ads have a visual aspect?
Oh.
Look at the fun we're having. And then also, if you're not already doubled over in laughter, it turns out the NSA basically is storing. They've created this time machine. I mean, we've talked about this, and there's been allusions to it, but they have the ability to store an entire country's phone calls. Which country is it? Well, it's not ours. They would never do that. I mean, why did they build that big Utah storage facility? Well, you know, audio, it takes some room. Believe me, I know. I pay for the servers just for our podcast alone. So they need space, man. All right, we will get into all of that and your phone calls at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. Hey, we're going to open up a special line for those libertarians who may be listening to the program and just had their minds blown by this notion that voluntarism is just not going to work and has never worked and has never been tried in this country. But you can call him. That number for libertarians is 646-257 3,920. And then for the rest of you, 646-257-3920. Folks, the Majority Report relies on your memberships to survive and thrive. Become a member today at majority.fm. If you buy crap on Amazon, by all means, buy it through our link. We get a kickback. You notice no difference. Go to majorityreportkickback.com. Majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the link. Bookmark the Amazon link. Always use it as Amazon. You'll notice no difference. We will. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. It's a great company. Great coffee. Get a coupon code majority. Get 10% off. Pick up the app today at majorityapp.com. We'll see you in the funner half.